Hello and happy Tuesday, July 30th, 2019. I'm Jim Swift, stepping in as guest host yet again for Charlie Sykes, who is on vacation. You're listening to the Bulwark Podcast, and I'm joined by my cohort, senior writer Andrew Egger.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Andrew, it's always great to have you here. Today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. We have a wonderful sponsor, and we'll hear a little bit more from them at about halftime. But Andrew, what's going on in your world today?
Oh, man. So many things. Just doing the news like we do here at the Bulwark. The first thing that I want to say, if you'll humor me, is I have a little bit of a message for our Bulwark podcast listeners. In the past, when I've been on this podcast, I've heard from a surprising number of you that I have a verbal tic that irritates some of our fine listeners, Jim, which is that I say sort of a lot. And apparently this is like a millennial thing to do, that it's
Are you couching?
Couching.
Allegedly, you know.
Oh,
you don't want to call someone a rapist or a murderer.
Well, yeah, I mean,
so
if you don't,
sort of a rapist,
I think that's a little bit to do with it. I mean, if you're having to grapple for it, then sort of just sort of lampshades
that's
the
a
fact
filler
that
word.
Yeah, but it's also it's a filler word that actually accurately denotes the thought process that's going on, right? Because I like to think of it as zeroing in on whatever term I'm about to come up with. But no longer, no more will I do this. I want to apologize to all of you out in TV land, especially those of you who have taken the time to so kindly remind me.
You know, I mean, that's a better, and that's my verbal tic is, you know, the ums and you knows.
Oh yeah, I do that. When I used to be on TV in a past life, which I haven't been on TV in a long time, thank God. But my tic then was obviously. I would say obviously a lot about things that weren't necessarily obvious.
So obvious. Well, yeah, you were there to make things obvious.
Yeah,
not have been.
Yeah, or maybe, yeah, and you know, also, I think, got in there from time to time. But, you know, we don't have to worry about that stuff these days.
It is. Well, we can always edit those things out, but...
it's so nice to be in-house. You know, we call all the shots. We got our hands on our weapons. We're not like, you know, nobody else controls our content but us this week.
That is true. Not Josh Hawley, yeah, well, which we can talk about here in a little bit.
Hey,
not
that
yet.
Was a segue for the ages.
Not,
that was good.
Not yet, anyway. But that is... That,
wasted, then.
I would rather get a valid complaint about what I said or how I said it, then you're fat, you know, because you're not. So you probably don't get that. You probably get soulless ginger is an insult.
Yeah, yeah. Some soulless ginger happens. You didn't have to tell them that. I mean, my Bulwark profile picture is
black and
white,
so people don't know. But I think, you know, they probably do know.
Yeah, right. Well, so who knows? They know now.
So before we get to Josh Hawley here, I wanted to read a statement here. Mike Pompeo on Kim Jong-un, because a lot of what we've been covering at the Bulwark recently has been about covering for Trump, right? Or whether or not you're not covering it, you're avoiding it or just letting it happen without condemning it, depending on what the outrage or concern du jour is. But part of this is explaining away the sort of unexplainable. And Republicans, of course, were very much against Obama maybe meeting with North Korea, right? And they of course flipped on that. What a great negotiator, the best guy ever. And here's this Pompeo quote. Look, this is on Kim Jong-un. Look, he's bright, has managed to rise to the level of leadership in a difficult environment where he was a very young man when his time came. And our friend Ala Pundit says, total respect to KJU for having navigated that ferocious North Korea meritocracy.
Yeah, he really pulled himself up by his bootstraps. That's wow. I like that. I like that. I think that's a nice thing to say.
And I guess maybe I didn't really know Mike Pompeo back when he was a kind of backbench congressman before he got elevated. And I followed him on Twitter and he seemed reasonable. And now it's just, it's, you know, shuffling a deck, and what unreasonableness do I have to drop today?
right. Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of goofy, right? I mean, it's there's another sort of, sorry everybody, it is sort of goofy, because obviously, you know, you see why this is happening. You know, the Trump stick and carrot approach is a very big stick and a very big carrot. He switches back and forth sort of at whim, and it creates some of this cognitive dissonance. But obviously, you know,
Well, look at him praising George Papadopoulos. He was calling him a coffee boy, an errand boy, a nobody. And then, you know, now all of a sudden he's praising George Papadopoulos for a book that I think was released in March, saying it would do very well. But I wonder, you know, did you read this story that apparently he has his aides print out tweets that he responds to and he signs them and he sends them?
That seems right. Yeah. I mean, well, that's a good gift for, I mean,
Matt Gaetz has one hanging in his office.
Yeah, right, right.
Just like Nancy Pelosi had a signed Donald Trump New York Times thing when she became Speaker.
Right, right.
He sent that to us.
I didn't know about that.
And signed it like, congratulations, Nancy. You'll be a wonderful Speaker, right, Donald Trump. And she had that in her office. I don't know if she still does.
Yeah. Well, one other thing about Pompeo is that I think is interesting is just this is the sort of thing that Trump responds to, right? I mean, it's when other world leaders sort of roll out the red carpet in terms of just, you know, personal compliments for him, that's like all he needs, right? And there is no world leader who gives him praise, who has buttered him up, who he will say, you know, a negative thing about, who he will like work against their interests and things like that. And we just see this, you know, time and time and time again. And I wonder whether there's just a little bit of, you know, him just thinking that's the way the world works. You know, all you have to do is say that Kim Jong-un is a nice guy. He's he's done well for himself and he'll hand over the nukes. I don't think it's going to work out quite that easily, but
you try that strategy with some of our detractors on Twitter.
I try. I mean, I talk about, you know, vacillating wildly between two poles. And that is, of course, my own Twitter strategy is just unbelievably, unfair and mean-spirited barbs, and then, you know, feeling guilty about that and trying to be nice in turn.
Well, I don't know. I tend to take a everything and everyone is awful approach. And
yeah.
if you view that through that lens, it makes the world that much easier.
Yeah. I mean, definitely easier. I think I would maybe despair a little more even than normal if I were to adopt quite that cynical of an approach. But maybe I mean, you're what? You're like exactly a decade older than me, right? So maybe I see my future in you. Who knows?
Oh gosh, that would be horrible. Speaking of the future and what we could probably expect to see, Josh Hawley making a name for himself again on technology by proposing a new bill. What are your thoughts on that? You kind of been nicer to Hawley than I have.
So yeah, let's talk about this. This is real news of the day. We've finally gotten there. Josh Hawley, freshman congressman, senator, I should say, from my home state of Missouri, knocked off Claire McCaskill in the 2018 election. And he has been making quite a name for himself as basically he wants to be both sort of a spokesman for this new sort of national conservatism brand that's beginning to really officially coalesce. They're throwing, you know, conferences and things now, so you know it's real. And Hawley has basically postured himself as a legislative leader for that, primarily by proposing a lot of bills going after big tech, which is a big, you know, boogeyman of this national conservative movement, and, you know, with some good reason, as we can talk about. But part of the problem with Hawley is, I first of all, he's the youngest guy in the Senate. He's sort of like the millennial senator, which I think is kind of interesting because he sort of runs his office the way that sort of millennial run media operations tend to go, where it's all about, you know, riding the news cycle and you know, getting out there first and a little bit less about necessarily the quality of the product. So a lot of these bills he's proposing now to bring it all the way around.
So it's move fast and break things.
Yeah, exactly. It's a move fast and
he's
break
just
things.
Like Mark Zuckerberg.
Exactly. So to bring it all the way around to the bill today, a big thing that Hawley has a bee in his bonnet about, again, we might differ about how much. You might say with some good reason, I might say a lot of good reason. He's got a bee in his bonnet about social media and the way it's sort of designed to be addictive, right? It's and it plays into this whole idea that, you know, a lot of things in our culture are sort of designed to get us sort of unhealthily dependent on them, and that's a bad thing. And Hawley thinks we ought to do something about that. And so this is sort of a pattern for Hawley is sort of a thus far, I'm all behind it, Josh. This is great. But then he comes out with this bill, and these bills that he keeps proposing, they read as though, you know, somebody, you know, threw up that problem. They like read that problem to like a group of college sophomores, and they're like, all right, has anybody got any ideas for how we might address this? And people just start throwing up their hands, and it's like, that's in the bill, and that's
limit
in the bill.
Social media use to 30 minutes a day.
Yeah. So that's like one of the most insane things. It's like you have to.
That might be a good guideline for life, but when the government actually proposes that as something that not as just like a finding, but as sort of an actual thing, that in and of itself is actually government censorship.
Right. So what the bill proposes is essentially that by default, the social media all needs to build into, all these companies need to build into themselves basically tracking for how much time you're spending on them, and then cut you off after 30 minutes a day unless you continually, like every 30 minutes or every week or something, opt out of this and say, no, I want to be doing more than 30 minutes a day. I want to do this. So there's all sorts of questions, obviously, about what that means, whether, you know, like different social media organizations need to by law now share data about their users, you know,
what
patterns
could,
of usage.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, with one another, with the government, like how does all that play out? Obviously, that's not really accommodated for in the bill. And then, you know, then that's just one of many provisions. I mean, it gets rid of
a couple other things that it would prohibit are infinite scroll, which if you've been on Facebook and you scroll down, it just keeps scrolling, right? If you go to web pages like Human Events, the revived Human Events just keeps scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. I don't believe the Bulwark is an infinite scroll, but at one point our old overlords at the Weekly Standard tried to get us to go with that.
I'm about to find out. I'm about to know whether we are in danger of this job. Nope. You get to the bottom of the page. What a nice looking web page, man.
It's a beautiful web page. They all do a great job.
Yeah.
But I hate infinite scroll.
Oh yeah,
I think, you know,
it's awful.
The only thing is bad. Only thing worse than infinite scroll is Josh Hawley's ideas about the internet. Loading of additional content without being expressly requested, that would kill Pandora. Yeah. You know, unless you say Alexa, tell Pandora to play the next song. Pandora just keeps playing songs.
Is Pandora still real?
Yeah.
Do you use Pandora?
Not really. I mean, I used it way. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Given my age, yeah, it was like early to the internet, mm-hmm. sort of mm-hmm. music before. Back then, you'd buy physical media and
right.
download it sometimes.
Right. I think everybody my age used Pandora until the day Spotify came out, and then they never looked back.
Yeah. So I still have the account. It's connected to my smart devices at home. But, you know, if you tell your smart device at home to shuffle your music, it's going to keep shuffling until you tell it to stop.
Right, yeah.
But that's also part of the thing. I can just tell it to stop. I don't need the government saying, you know, like, do you consent to having another song played? Or do you consent to having another YouTube video loaded up? There's also a button right there, auto load and whatnot. You just, this literally right there next to the video, you just click it.
Right.
I mean, the solutions are already out there. So I think, you know, Hawley's prescriptions for maybe how to live a better life online would be good if he wrote like Chicken Soup for the Internet Soul by Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. But when you start,
I'd buy that book.
But yeah, when you start,
I would request a review copy of that book and get it for free.
Yeah, but when you start, you know, proposing the government start getting involved in this, and I'm very much a libertarian on this, which is why I'm so down on Hawley. But the good news is it's not going to go anywhere probably, but. You know, we're talking about it because there hasn't been a lot of thought leadership in the Republican Party, and this is, I guess, what qualifies for it.
Right, now. Right. So here's what's interesting about this whole thing to me, because on the surface of it, it's just, you know, here's another sort of pie in the sky, the way I would like the country to sort of be shaped from above, bill from Josh Hawley that's going to go nowhere. But what's interesting is the fact that it's part of a sort of wider trend here. And we were talking a little bit about national conservatism, right? Again, there's beginning to be this sense that, you know, obviously Trump's not going to be around forever, but you know, there are a lot of people who, some more well-meaningly, some less, I think, are trying to figure out how we're going to sort of pick up the strands of what, you know, changes have been wrought to
the
country, to the right, to the Republican Party, and you know what all that's going to look like. And, you know, so there was this conference recently,
the National
last
Conservatism.
Month. And there were both, you know, some crazies there, and there were some, you know, relatively respectable people who I'm trying to think, was Ramesh Panuru, maybe at the conference?
J.D. Vance was there.
Yeah. I mean, people who just think that, you know, the way the Republican Party has been operating has had a lot of flaws, and that, you know, whatever you think about you know, Trump in this particular moment, you might as well, you know, take the opportunity of the chaos to try to sort of move fast and break things and come out the other side with maybe a better understanding of
reformicons are dead.
Well, right.
Now it's what flavor of nationalism do you want to be?
Right. So the question or the interesting thing about this to me, and specifically about Hawley, and I think I've maybe talked about this on the podcast a little bit before, but right now this national conservatism stuff is pretty much it's getting a lot of mileage out of the fact that it defines itself really oppositionally. You know, it's obviously against the left, but it's also sort of against it's against the libertarians, it's against the Chamber of Commerce types, it's against sort of never Trump types, obviously, because we're sort of seen as a desiccated and as a, you know, people who want to return to some sort of dead consensus, right?
And there's also sort of a theocracy aspect to this.
Yeah, I mean, for some people, definitely. And this is exactly what I want to get at, is that the through lines are a lot more in condemning each of these things in turn, even though, you know, one or another of those things, a lot of the people who sort of subscribe to this idea that there's something to this national conservatism, some of them, you know, might sort of like the free market stuff, or some of them might sort of like the libertarian aspects of things, and so it's sort of an uneasy coalition right now, and so to bring this all the way around, the reason why this is so interesting when it comes to Hawley is because Hawley is positioning himself as sort of the big lawmaker, maybe alongside say Ted Cruz, of sort of the future of this thing. You know, he's a young, fresh new face in Congress. He sort of came in both speaking the language of populism and of sort of constitutional conservatism, which is, you know, kind of funny in retrospect.
Cruz has been spending more of his time, you know, like standing for diamond and silk,
right?
And like,
so this is exactly where I wanted to go, because a lot of the people who are most supportive of Hawley and a lot of these bills that he's proposing are these very, very online conservatives. It's these people who have built themselves up into basically, you know, C or D list internet celebrities and sort of been able to make a living.
Steven Crowder and Ted Cruz went on Steven Crowder's show.
Yeah,
but
Crowder even, you know, a little bit more institutional than somebody like Diamond and Silk, or people like, you know, I don't know, Laura Loomer or Mike Cernovich, or all these guys.
He's a meme. Change my mind.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, but so these people, these very online people have sort of grasped on to, say, Cruz and Hawley as their champions, and the reason is because they're obsessed with the idea of, you know, censorship and the fact that, you know, all these big tech companies are left wing and discriminate against conservatives and so on and so forth. And Hawley does speak that language. I mean, Hawley and Cruz both are constantly, you know, banging those drums as well. And so they see themselves as sort of their content creators, these online basically political celebrities on the right.
On Fox News.
Yeah,
the base
yeah.
loves Fox News. Ergo, uh-huh. the base will love Josh Hawley.
Well, yeah, and they love Hawley and Cruz. But the interesting thing is that I think that is sort of just a marriage of convenience, right? Because what we see from this bill with Hawley and other things that Hawley has proposed and talked about in the past is that Josh Hawley's ideal universe is not one in which you know, even right wing YouTubers and Twitch streamers and all these things are just, you know, making money hand over fist, cashing in on, you know, Republicans' addiction to social media, which is just the same as everybody else's addiction to social media. Josh Hawley's ideal world puts a lot of these content creators who are right now his biggest fans, you know, out of a lot of money, maybe out of a job. He sort of wants to break the stranglehold that internet culture has on all of us. You know,
if you have 30 minutes a day, that limits the monetization.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you can't. Alex Jones's show is what, 4 hours long,
right,
every day.
Or Ben Shapiro, or, you know, or Stephen Crowder. And whatnot, it really does limit, unless, you know, you get it through a cable TV box. And cable TV in and itself is addicting. I mean, CNN with those gosh darn countdowns, everything's a countdown.
Uh-huh.
You know, the bong, you know, the Fox News bong, or, you know, the breaking news. I mean, everything is meant to be addictive. As someone who studied marketing, you can't stop that in society. I mean, people will, and you see this. And I think that's one of my biggest critiques of part of the Hawley bill. I mean, there's so much we could probably spend another couple hours on it, but we'll try and keep this to a tight 40. Whenever people would get banned, and I don't know of many accounts, and I'm very online on the right, that I've thought of like, you know, that was really unfair what big tech did to them, right? But you would see some of these accounts, some of the accounts that troll us and whatnot, and you look at their profiles and they say, wait, they have backup accounts. People would create backup accounts, backup phones, you know, backup computer devices. Where there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, to quote Jurassic Park, life finds a way. It's chaos theory.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And so, look, I maybe a little less sort of like, what can you do about all of this than you seem to be? And I'm not for necessarily any good reason. Personally, I am really sympathetic to, you know, Holly's critique of all of these things. And there's a new book out this spring called The Age of Addiction by David Courtwright, which I have not yet read. It's on my list of things to read. But I, you know, from what I've read about this book, it's just sort of a kind of a harrowing look at the ways in which our culture is built around addiction in a way that, you know, human beings obviously and just life in general tends to fall into habits that are not good for it, not good for people. We're sort of notoriously weak at resisting temptation as a species and everything, but the sort of the new thing of the modern age is just that we have become so good at getting what we want, right? I mean, there's no scarcity for many of the sort of addictions that plague us, which are all around all of us all the time, right? You can get what you want.
The golden age of addiction.
Yeah, I mean, as far as sort of entertainment products are concerned, as far as sort of things that sort of distract you from the drudgery and misery of life, you sort of have your pick. I mean, it could be drugs or alcohol or TV or Twitter or collecting,
usually mixing those things.
Lego sets, yeah, right. I mean, it just,
man, was that a JBL reference?
The Lego sets? I'm mad at him because he didn't want to come hang out with us for the podcast today. But
there was a good story in the Post this Sunday, and I shared it in the newsletter yesterday about the never Googlers, the degree to which some people choose to avoid with Google.
Right, right. Which is just really, really hard. I mean, that's like, that's another question, right? I mean, is it just, and it's tangentially related because Google controls so many, or Facebook controls, you know, these companies do have an enormous amount of leverage in all of these products to which many of us are so hopelessly addicted. And I'm totally on board with Holly and Courtwright and all these people who see this as an extremely pressing sort of social problem, right? That it is in some ways sort of the pressing problem of our current age. It's just that we have become so good at getting ourselves everything we want, but we remain so bad at, you know, keeping ourselves sort of healthily in a healthy relationship to all these things that we want. The problem obviously is just that, you know, that isn't everything you need to know. You know, like that's correctly identifying that problem does not guarantee that any steps you take to address that problem are going to make good law, right? I mean, that is sort of the key problem here.
I'm not sure any good law can come out of this. That's the skeptic in me.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly not, you know, the first thing that some people in Holly's office dashed off within a couple of months of him taking office. I mean, at least it seems to have clearly become apparent that wasn't going to work because the laws that have been proposed haven't been all that good, right? I mean, so I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, like we as a society have in the past been able to sort of pull ourselves back from the brink of various things like this. I mean, like, human beings have an enormous propensity for bloodshed and violence, but we have not so far nuked ourselves into smithereens, despite having had the capacity to do so for a very long time. You know, we as a nation were horribly, heinously addicted to tobacco for a very long time, and have since the public health crisis that represented sort of became obvious, we've been able to sort of pull ourselves back from the brink of that, in part through intrusive federal interventions like the sort of thing that Holly is proposing for social media. So I think I'm a little more reluctant to just sort of write off the notion that anything can be done at the top level.
But what will result in this, and what we saw with tobacco, and there's questions about the constitutionality of a lot of what went down with tobacco's stuff, because a lot of that ended up being settlements. Mm-hmm. And the companies wanted it because they were like, regulate us. You can't quit us. That's what a lot of this debate
right.
will turn into is, you know, at some point, if Facebook or Google or Twitter or, you know, any of these entities sees that like Holly's actually probably going to get something what he wants, then they get on board and then they secure their market share.
Right.
You know, so TikTok doesn't come in and start encroaching on it.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that's sort of my worry about a lot of these things. And a lot of it's parenting. You know, I mean, my kids are young. And I've kind of taken a lot of instruction from Jonathan about screen time and kids. And I kind of thought to myself, like, man, you know, he only lets them use like Kindle Fires on like road trips or things. And, you know, I don't know what kind of future my kids are going to be raised in. I mean, it's just amazing to me, given my age, I sort of have ridden the wave of the internet. I've always been the age of which you kind of have mastery of these things. Uh-huh. So, you know, smartphones didn't exist when I was in college. You know, in high school, very few people had cell phones, AOL Instant Messenger, and all this sort of stuff. And so, I mean, I'm not at the age where I'm not technically proficient. I still very much am. But I kind of think, man, like the nature of education for my kids is going to be so different. I mean, I went to a very nice private Catholic high school. And it was well-funded, so we had, like, laptops with Wi-Fi that would come in on a laptop cart. But now everyone has their own devices. You didn't have to worry about kids. I mean, we would play video games on our TI-89 calculators. You know, now it's different. And I get Holly's point about the addiction. I mean, playing the worm game on, you know, that you self-loaded onto the TI-89, not the same as playing, like, one of those, you know, games you see advertisements for where you get new levels and all.
Hey, don't sleep on the worm game. That's a classic.
It is classic.
I've spent many happy hours with not on a TI-80. I don't think I ever on friends' Nokia phones. That was always a thing.
Yeah, right, or right. Brick Breaker. Yeah, right, on the right. BlackBerry.
So just to go back to your point about, you know, the settlements and everything. I you know, me personally, I think there's no question that you're right about that, that this is not a problem that can be, you know, solved at the federal level in the sense that, you know, you pass the correct piece of legislation and voila, nobody's addicted to their phones anymore. You know, I mean, that's clearly that's not the case. And so I do think that the one sort of concerning thing that's missing from Holly's approach to all of these things is that he does not seem to have that sort of, you know, very conservative sort of epistemological humility and skepticism and fear of unintended consequences and things like that that habitually, you know, would make conservatives want to, you know, move slowly and carefully about addressing something like this. But you know, I also see sort of Holly's point that, you know, these are pressing problems that are hurting us now, and certainly we have to do something. And so he's just, you know, proposing legislation that he thinks is good. So it's not good. It's bad legislation. But I, you know, so I guess I'm just emoting through the ways in which I personally am sort of tormented by this. It doesn't help that I was very taken by Holly from the beginning when I was covering his campaign for the Weekly Standard a year or so ago, and I feel responsible. Not that I had anything to do with him getting elected by writing nice things about him in a magazine, but I, you know, I just like, hey, come on, man.
You well, how could you have known, right? Just like our friend Bill McMorris covered Eric Greitens.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, went to his house and did workouts. It's like, who could have known that was also a sex dungeon?
Well, yeah, I mean, I always didn't really like Greitens, but I think that the that had more to do with sort of my fear of physically fit people. You know?
Well, there was also some stuff out there, you know, kind of rumors about like people in the Navy SEAL community and what they thought
right,
of him and
right.
stuff like that.
Yes, yes. He's so always sort of a, there were question marks about him from the get-go.
First half of the podcast will be about Missouri and Missouri politicians. We'll be back to talk about books we're reading, podcasts we're listening to after a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from getting to know their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control that you need to grow. With NetSuite, you will save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or your phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you, dear Bulwark listener, valuable insights with a free guide called 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits at netsuite.com/bulwark. That's netsuite.com/bulwark. Go there and download your free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. Once again, netsuite.com/bulwark. And we're back with Andrew Ager. We're approaching the end of baseball, and I know you, as a diehard Cardinals fan, have been watching the NL Central. Yes or no? Or
Jim, I am ashamed to report that I have fallen off of my sort of ordinarily histrionic viewing of Cardinals baseball. This and it's been a bad time to do so because they've actually been kind of hot. But when they were looking just really miserable and down in the doldrums,
just like
through,
the Blues,
through June and everything. I know. I really ought to keep the faith. I feel bad. So it's sort of the difference between just vice and sin, right? I mean, like it's not that I'm just out here, you know, ignoring my team and just feeling fine. And I know that I'm falling short. I know that I owe these people some of my loyalty and my time, and my attention, and I feel ashamed that I have been failing to do so. But I really mean this is one of the key roles that you play in my life, not just as a coworker, but as sort of an avenging presence in my psyche, where I need you to come and be like, hey.
Do you watch that? You know, did you watch Trevor Bauer get pulled from the game the trade deadline?
Jim, I didn't
he threw
see
the
that.
Ball out of the ballpark in Kansas City.
That sounds
from
pretty
the
cool.
The Indians, you know, my Indians are making a run at the Twins, and they've been one of the hot teams in the AL. So I've been watching a lot of those games and tuning into some of the later Cardinals games too.
Yeah, I mean, last I checked, which I actually think this is probably no longer true because we just dropped 2 games to the Astros. But there was a brief moment where we were all of a sudden back on top of the division after just looking wretched for you know weeks and weeks and weeks. So I don't really know how the numbers add up. I'm sure they do. I'm sure somebody's checked those, but
it's going to be a good fight to the finish.
Yeah, no, so. I'm excited. You have my word. I will be tuning in more and more frequently because of the sort of person and fan that I am. I'm not proud of it, but yeah. So we're going down the stretch.
So reading lists, if you haven't been spending time watching baseball, you've been doing much reading or listening to podcasts?
Less podcasts. I actually have been reading some. I'm sort of ashamed of what I've been reading, which is a lot of Evelyn Waugh.
Okay.
Yeah, I've read Brideshead Revisited because my wife told me it was good, and I read it at a wedding that we were at.
Oh, you were like a reader?
No. We were lounging around the hotel a lot because we're not very social. We didn't want to like go to bars and things. But yeah, and I liked that a lot. So I've been working through a couple of his stuff. I just started a book that JVL recommended that I read, or he didn't recommend it, but he was talking about it. And I just decided it sounded fun. But it's a history of Saturday Night Live, which is kind of just like all in. It's weird. I've never read a book that's like situated in this way, but the entire book is just quotes. It's just like this guy who was a.
Then you'll find out who Molly Shannon is.
Before hey, I'm
the
ready.
Show,
I'm
we
ready.
We were talking, and Andrew didn't know Molly Shannon.
Yeah, well, sorry. You don't have to out me about all of these things.
Well, I really know Molly Shannon based on my age, and she's also from the same town
part
school
of,
that I went to.
Part of the mystique of a podcast, perhaps you know, is that we are seen as sort of reliable founts of knowledge because we pick the topics and we edit out the parts where we sound dumb. But when you go and you say, when you talk about things that I don't know about, that shatters
I'm
the illusion and makes me look foolish.
Sorry.
So I would just appreciate
not to attack your credibility here. I've been listening to reading Tim Alberta's book.
Oh yeah. I have not got my hands on it. Can I borrow that when you're done with it?
I have an ebook.
Oh.
But
well,
I'm sure we have a physical copy lying around here.
I should really just buy it.
Well, I mean, Tim Albert is a great guy.
It's a dying profession we're in.
Yes.
Yeah.
I say that as I canceled my subscription to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today.
Oh, no, really?
Well, I'm just cutting back on expenses with the move and everything. But I subscribe to local newspapers for like the limited period where it's cheap, and then I cancel
it. Right,
because I want to give them some money, but I don't read. I mean, I read a lot of Blues content during the playoffs.
Uh-huh.
But is it worth $10 a month to me? No, I mean, now I'm just go back and switch to the plain dealer, probably.
Do they send you, like, like every time you resubscribe, do they do, like, that New Yorker thing where they send you another tote bag?
Not for digital stuff. I like, you know, a lot of this stuff goes behind the paywall. Sports stuff especially mm-hmm. ends up there. And mm-hmm. I read The Athletic, too, which is worth your money if you're really into sports. But
right.
Depending on what city in which you live.
It's so interesting how, like, all of the sort of legacy forms of media, sports is really a thing that they... is sort of their last lifeline, you know? I mean, that's definitely true of cable TV.
Well, they're also blowing it because they laid off a bunch of people, and that's how The Athletic was able to just scoop
right.
up a bunch of talent in all these cities.
Right. You know, it's hard. I mean, it's just a tough... I mean,
local journalism is a tough biz.
So I want you to tell me about Tim Alberta's book, but real quick before you say that, I was reading something this morning just talking about how... A lot of the places that have gotten so sort of crazy and just sort of just to sort of put it kind of bluntly, a lot of places that are like super Trumpy now are you know, places where a lot of people sort of live in pretty much just sort of a whirlwind of sort of crazy conservative, far out, wackadoodle Alex Jones type news. Are a lot of these environments where sort of the local news has sort of shriveled up and died, which actually makes a kind of sense when you think about it. It's like
yeah.
these people are not able to now sort of have an actual part of their community be responsible for sort of curating news and sort of keeping them informed and things like that. And it's harder to, you know, to build sort of like a reliable rapport between sort of a media institution and the people who are reading when that media institution is, you know, perceived as distant and other and, you know, culturally different, you know, for people who aren't you, sort of the things they write about people like you perceive as
yeah.
sort of not kind to you or not understanding of your culture or things like that. So I think this is anyway, I was just reading an article about this, but I all these things are sort of wrapped up together. It's not so good.
Obviously, the internet has cut into local journalism, right? Mm-hmm. And I know talk radio, of course. I mean, people get their alternatives, but you're not going to get local news from Mark Levin, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, traffic and weather with Mark Levin. There's a crash at 141 and 270.
Hey,
you know,
yeah.
Stay to the right lane. Since local news, and you know, I've seen the way the Cleveland Plain Dealer has shrunk and how news wires and affiliations with like the Washington Post and the New York mm-hmm. Times, because, you know, a lot of these papers used to have bureaus here in Washington. Mm-hmm. Now they have maybe one person,
right,
if that.
Right.
And to cover their local politicians and whatnot. And so they outsource a lot of this now. But I remember living in St. Louis, and we just conservatives be like, it's the St. Louis Post disgrace. You know, they just got that liberal Bill McClellan and Joe Manies, and they
right,
hate
right.
us, and I'm not going to give them any money. And
yeah, having the people be sort of in your town is not necessarily a sort of flood wall against fake news and
yeah,
things like
and
that.
Yeah, and I've never really understood this refusal to give money to local papers. I mean, it's like the Wall Street Journal, the editorial board and its reporting are just vastly different. I mean, mm-hmm. and it always has been that way. And not all newspapers are exactly the same. I mean, the alt weeklies are clearly leftist, mm-hmm. right? I mean, they're not conservative alt weeklies that are popping up there. But
did you ever read the Riverfront Times when you were?
Yeah, I read the Riverfront Times all the time. They do a great job on a lot of local reporting that, you know, Lee Enterprises and the Post-Dispatch people would not do
mm-hmm.
Or choose not to do. And they you know, they pick out these things. So in addition to talk radio and local talk radio, because there is the local host, mm-hmm. we have this guy, Mike Trevisano in Cleveland, and, you know, he was Trump before Trump. Very Trumpy guy. Geraldo Rivera now lives in Cleveland where he has a local talk radio
hey,
show.
That's great. That's great.
And
yeah, going back to the roots.
But blogs, you know, blogs, early conservative political blogs sort of supplanted that,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, you'd see that on local political coverage too. I mean, like every city and every state capital kind of had their own sort of, you know, privately run sort of renegade band of political coverage. But, you know, those things are sort of dying off.
Right.
You know, I mean, Gateway Pundit. Who we all know is kind of a conspiratorial far-right source.
Right.
It's Gateway because it's the gateway to the West, because it's St. Louis. It spent a lot of time covering local stuff. And, you know, I probably read Gateway Pundit. I don't remember what my internet browsing habits were 17 years ago or however many years ago is when it started. But I probably read it. And, you know, now it's nuts. It was probably nuts then too. Who knows? Jim Hoff, the guy who runs it, interesting cat. But it's interesting to me, and I just keep using the word interesting.
You're gonna get tweets.
Yeah,
Andrew says sort of, and Jim says interesting.
Everything. I just find it all so interesting. But just the changes in the whole market and people's general refusal to pay for a lot of things, and I think that fascinates me. I'm going to switch from interesting to fascinates me. And we have a lot of generous listeners and readers here who make donations because we don't have a paywall at the Bulwark, and the only ads we have right now are podcast ads, and we'd like to keep it that way. But I find that hard to come back from because Twitter is free. You know, that's the joke. How is this website free? And everyone is doing that. And how do you square a revenue model unless you go to something like The Athletic,
which is
wholly behind a paywall? You can
and the conversation that we're sort of cycling around right now is just sort of the if we were actually a leftist podcast as opposed to just purportedly a secretly leftist podcast, then perhaps the way we would be framing this conversation is as sort of these are just sort of the downsides and the failings of sort of big business capitalism where you know
the failure of consumers too.
Well, but consumers sort of following market pressures, right? Because why would you continue to pay for a product when you're getting a product that
they gave it away
just
for free.
Well, for free?
They gave it away for free for too long, and then they were like, oh crap, you know, we have to charge for this now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Wait. So you got to tell me about Tim Alberta's book.
Yes, I was pulling it up. And you can find so many good choice excerpts on Tim's Twitter account and Politico and other places that have done it. And he's came on a podcast, so listen in. He's got some good anecdotes
And
there.
It's called?
American Carnage.
American Carnage. I couldn't remember.
Yeah. I thought you were putting me on the spot. I'm like, oh, do I remember? Yes, I remember. But so Tim and I are about the same age. And he just reported on Twitter that his dad passed away last night and, you know, was just here for his book release party, and it's very sad. Tim's a really good guy, and Tim actually kind of came through the conservative media world before – I mean, he worked at National Review and other places. And I'd never met Tim before he came and did the podcast. Very nice guy and well-regarded as a well-sourced and an ethical reporter among all the people I know in the press corps. So he came to Washington and went straight into journalism when I was in government. So having him kind of recount part of what I got to see when I was working in Congress as an aide over the years before I came to the Standard, during all these tumultuous times of the end of the Bush administration, immigration reform, you know, back when Republicans actually tried to do immigration reform, not demagogue the issue seven times to next Sunday, it was haunting to relive parts of my life that I would prefer to have forgotten, you know, the 2008 financial crisis and the McCain campaign and sort of their inept response and Boehner dealing with the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party and, you know, a lot of things I had sort of a third row seat to as a junior aide on the Hill. So it was fun to relive those sorts of things. They're parts I'd probably just rather forget. But it's a really good book, and I'm probably like 25% of the way through. And it's written in such a readable fashion that you don't feel like you're reading Robert Caro. And I don't mean to single out Caro, but it's I mean, he was a good writer. But it's not one of these huge slogs where you're just like, oh my gosh, I only have 500 pages left to go. It is eminently readable. I don't think it's a book that you could easily read in a day, like Barton Swaim's The Speechwriter, which is, you know, our old colleague Barton Swaim's book, which I read that in a day. It was just so readable. But it's a really good book. And if you want to understand how the Republican Party got right here to where it is and why people are acting or not acting in ways that you would kind of assume or expect or hope them to, it really is a good kind of narrative. And people are already telling him, oh, you have to write the book about 2020. And he's just like, no, dude, this took like, you know, years and years of source building and reporting and getting to know people to get them to do it. You can't just, you know, flip a switch and do one of these things in a year. I mean, like they're going to be two dozen 2020 election books. I'm sure.
It's
maybe we'll
be a
even
deluge.
Have one here at the Bulwark.
am I telling on myself if I admit that I never got through Bob Woodward's Trump book? What was that? Fear, I think that was the one.
Yeah, I don't think I read that one either.
Yeah, I just
or maybe I bought it, but I didn't.
It felt like inevitable. I mean, like it was one of those ones where it came out and everyone's like, oh, this book's coming out. It was sort of like what was Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury?
But both of those books, people were attacking the sourcing.
Right.
And not just like in a Trumpian way, like you can never believe it. But like,
right. Well, Wolff's what like just fell to pieces, right? I mean, yes. he was spreading rumors about Nikki Haley and the president. That was just he did that crazy. I remember that interview that he did where he was like pretending he couldn't hear the interviewer in his earpiece and all that. But that was true of Woodward's as well. I don't remember that.
Less to the degree. Uh-huh. I'm not trying to make a direct comparison between Wolff and Woodward, but there are some people who cast doubts on some of these Woodward books.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Tim Alberta has that problem. I've literally seen no one cast any doubt.
Right, right.
Because he's such a boy scout.
Well, the interesting thing to me, and here I go now with interesting, is, I started the Woodward book and I got a little ways into it and it just felt like, well, I was asking myself, what is the point of this? Because this book has already been sort of endlessly dissected and all of the actual juicy bits sort of gone over on Twitter and in little write-ups of the book and everything. And then I read a review that our former colleague Andy Ferguson, now at the Atlantic, had written of a Woodward book like 20 years prior. And the way he kicked off that review was like, time for another Woodward cycle where it's like, a gradually coalescing wave of anticipation, followed by sort of all this fireworks show of reveals of different parts of the book placed in different, you know, news outlets as excerpts and things like that. And everybody sort of goes crazy about all the new news for a little while. And then a couple weeks later, the book finally arrives.
You're just
it's
reading
sort of,
the filler of what
yeah,
you
it's
already
just, it's
know.
Limp. Yeah, it's like everything, all the fun parts of the book you've already digested. It's like having doing a book like that is like, you know, eating dessert first or something like that.
And that's why I think Alberta's book is a little bit different, because it does go so far back to the glory days of the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. That I forgot about a lot of things I was there kind of experiencing and dealing with in real time. But whereas these books, like Woodward and whatnot, a good book reveals what happens behind the curtain, but when the curtain is stuck halfway up for the entire play, a lot of times there really is no mystique
right.
to what's going on, because it's so much of it is taking place in plain sight.
Right, right, right.
The private anecdotes about who told who to F off. Could you have ever expected Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon didn't get along? Shocker!
Right, right, right. Although that is one kind of weird thing about our current time, right? Because it's still just as performative as it ever was, right? I mean, Donald Trump is not saying the same things in Twitter or in interviews or in speeches or what have you that he's saying to his advisors. I mean, he's a lot more. At least if any of the many behind the scenes things that have been reported about the Trump administration are to be believed, he's sort of a little bit more conscious of his own sort of vulnerabilities
it's
and things behind the
if
scenes.
It's not collusion, it took place in public.
Right, right. But what's so different and strange is that because his persona as he presents sort of in Twitter and everything is so brash and so sort of transgressive and all of these things, it's as though people think that there is no behind the scenes then that he really is just saying what he thinks sort of artlessly. Yeah. and it's all right out there for you to see just because he's being sort of gross and mean.
Yeah.
But being gross and mean doesn't mean you're not keeping things back. It
but then
mean
there
you're
are
particularly
those anecdotes like Gary Cohn took the piece of paper off his desk.
Right, right. You know, yeah, yeah.
Those things you don't find out about. But how sexy is it that, you know, a finance whiz is pulling off, you know, being the adult in the room. But we're also seeing there's so few adults in the room that's what makes the ride even more addictive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So all that to say, you know, don't rule it out. Could get some fun Tim Alberta type content come 2024, 2026. As Donald Trump is completing his second or halfway through his third term.
Yes, he is a content king. Well, Andrew, thanks for making the time to join us today here in the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hey, it's a lot of fun as always.
And thanks to our advertiser, NetSuite. Remember, you can go and get your copy of 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits at netsuite.com/bulwark. And thank you very much for listening. We will be back tomorrow where we will do this all over again.